Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Downing Street memo wasn't the only news to come out of Tony Blair's visit to the White House. Debt relief and aid to Africa made headlines. But what was missing from the media coverage? We'll ask Sally Booker of Africa Action. Also this week, the Pentagon says they don't do body counts, but it's not true. An increasing number of news stories are quoting military officials who cite body counts of dead Iraqi insurgents. We'll talk to journalist Mark Benjamin of Salon.com about what he says is a troubling practice born of the military's desperation to show progress in the Iraq war. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
After over a month of scant media attention, mainstream U.S. outlets have begun to report seriously about the Downing Street memo, the minutes of a July 2002 meeting of British government officials that indicate the White House had already made up its mind to invade Iraq at that early date, and that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of invasion. With the new attention has come a backlash against activists who have been bringing attention to the memo. After Washington Post reporter Dana Milbank referred to these activists as wingnuts in a June 8th article, LA Times editorial page editor Michael Kinsley picked up the baton, deriding those same activists in a June 12th column for sending him emails, quote, demanding that I cease my personal cover-up of something called the Downing Street memo, close quote. He kidded that the fuss was a good sign for the left, quote, developing a paranoid theory and promoting it to the very edge of national respectability takes ideological self-confidence, close quote. But criticizing the LA Times for not giving the story much attention would be accurate. The paper's first story on the memo appeared nearly 2 weeks after the story broke, and nothing else appeared until Bush was finally asked about the memo weeks later. Kinsley paired his mocking with a familiar media defense. This is all old news. On the early decision to go to war, Kinsley wrote, quote, you don't need a secret memo to know this, close quote. And as for intelligence manipulation, Kinsley acknowledged that, quote, we know now that this was true, close quote. In other words, this paranoid theory is pretty accurate. His only quarrel with what he calls a vast conspiracy, pushing the mainstream media to take the memo more seriously, is that activists think such information is important, whereas Kinsley, and apparently many others in the mainstream media, doesn't buy the fuss.
A Washington Post June 12th front pager must have come as a shock to even careful readers of the press, a rare challenge to a pervasive White House message. The headline told the story. U.S. campaign produces few convictions on terrorism charges. Statistics often count lesser crimes. The article began with the claim George Bush and other officials like to make that federal terrorism investigations have nabbed 400 suspects, with more than half of those suspects convicted. But Post writers Dan Egan and Julie Tate don't mince words, declaring the administration numbers misleading at best. The Post independent analysis of the Justice Department's terrorism prosecution shows that 39 people, not 200 as the White House implies, have been convicted of crimes related to terrorism or national security. Most of the others were convicted of lesser crimes, such as making false statements or passport violations. As an indication of the seriousness of the crimes, the medium sentence doled out was 11 months. The Washington Post won't get any thank you cards from the White House for this story, and readers probably weren't comforted to learn how the administration is exaggerating its success in catching suspected terrorists. But as one source in the story says, this kind of book cooking is dangerous since it means, quote, we have no accurate assessment of whether the war on terrorism is actually working, close quote. So the Post is to be credited for running an important story prominently just because it's important. Now we'll see if other news outlets follow suit.
Well, the Howard Dean scream is back. Reporters have been buzzing about controversial comments the new head of the Democratic Party has been making. The GOP is primarily a white Christian party, for one, and that long voting lines in Florida and Ohio didn't affect some Republicans, who don't have to worry about taking a work day off to vote because many of them, quote, have never made an honest living in their lives, close quote. The media reaction, unsurprisingly, was critical, but it was interesting to see just how critical. Newsweek magazine recalled Dean's comment about the GOP's white Christian majority, but added a snide rejoinder, quote, as if that were some kind of a crime, close quote. Dean hadn't actually mentioned a desire to arrest any Republicans, though. But Newsweek poured on more interpretation, quote, by labeling the other party a bastion of Christianity, he implied that his own was something else, something determinedly secular, close quote. Again, we're not sure how Newsweek arrived at that conclusion. But getting hepped up about Howard Dean is, by this point, a media ritual. The so-called Dean of the Washington Press Corps, Washington Post columnist David Broder, also took a swipe on the June 12th edition of NBC's Meet the Press. He scolded Dean for not talking about more important issues, quote, by focusing so much on himself, Howard Dean, as a spokesman for the party, has really done a disservice to the party, close quote. But that's projection. Dean hasn't been talking about himself. The media are the ones who have turned this whole affair into yet another chance to psychoanalyze Howard Dean. If anyone's guilty of ignoring substantive issues, it's the press corps.
It's a fact that labor unions are seldom heard in the mainstream media. What's rarer still is hearing anyone in the media talk about the scarcity. But that's exactly what MSNBC host Chris Matthews did on June 10th. I watch Sunday television, Matthews explained to Bill Moyers, and, quote, I never see a really good articulate labor leader on television, close quote. Matthews added, quote, where are the strong articulate voices of the working person, the working family out there, close quote. Well, there's no denying that labor leaders aren't invited to the Sunday morning media roundtables, but Matthews says that's the fault of the labor movement, quote, they don't have speakers. I'm telling you, I can't think right now of a labor leader that could match wits with Dick Cheney on television. They don't want to get out there and debate like they used to, close quote. No one in the labor movement could debate Dick Cheney? That might be true, since it's doubtful that Cheney would ever agree to debate anyone. But even more importantly, how would Matthews know that no one in the labor movement is willing to debate? He says he watches Sunday TV, but Matthews also hosts a Sunday morning television show, and it's not exactly overflowing with labor guests. When Moyers suggested that grassroots activists across the country could debate Bush administration policies, Matthews quipped, quote, well, they should get elected to Congress. Then we will put them on, close quote. So only politicians get to play hardball. Sounds like Matthews answered his own question about the dearth of labor spokespeople on his show.
And finally, the case of Natalie Holloway, the Alabama teenager missing in Aruba, has been big news on cable TV. On June 9th, Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly boasted about his show's responsible approach to the story. Quote, as you may know, we do not speculate here on the factor. We have no idea what happened to Natalie or why she left the bar with some Aruban men. I've heard some irresponsible media speculate about that, and it makes me angry. Close quote. Well, that sermon might have been puzzling to regular O'Reilly viewers, accustomed to a steady flow of speculation on any number of stories, including the Natalie Holloway case. Quote, looks like she's dead, because the five people, two arrested, three interviewed, are all shady characters, close quote. That's O'Reilly himself on his June 6th show. Amidst much other speculation on the same show, O'Reilly repeatedly stated that Holloway was, quote, at the bottom of the ocean, close quote. This is nothing new for O'Reilly. A few months earlier, speaking of runaway bride Jennifer Wilbanks, O'Reilly declared emphatically, it's got to be a crime. She just wouldn't bolt and not tell anybody. In 2001, he declared that Saddam Hussein was, quote, involved with this World Trade Center and Pentagon bombing, close quote. And before the invasion of Iraq, on various occasions, O'Reilly speculated that military action would not last more than a few hours or weeks. For what it's worth, when FAIR activists contacted O'Reilly to ask how he could claim that he doesn't speculate, the host responded by dismissing them as being among publicity-seeking smear merchants who weren't worthy of engagement. Now, we could speculate about what he really means by that, but that wouldn't be fair, would it?
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The relationship between George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been showing signs of stress recently, but Blair's White House visit earlier this month generated some headlines about Africa, namely that the U.S. was dedicating new aid money and was involved in a multi-billion dollar commitment to eliminate the debt obligations of some poor nations. Joining us now to explain just what was promised and what wasn't is Sally Booker, the Executive Director of Africa Action. Sally Booker, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with what we might even want to call this aid package the White House announced earlier this month, $674 million, usually referred to as additional funding or even new money by the media. Is that right?
Well, we refer to it as a sham. This was money that the Congress had already authorized, and this is emergency food assistance. This is not development aid. Tony Blair came to Washington trying to get George Bush to make a commitment to double the amount of U.S. development assistance for poor countries. This is part of a larger campaign globally to get rich countries to double the amount of development assistance they provide poor countries in order to help them meet the Millennium Development Goals, i.e. to reduce poverty worldwide by the year 2015. George Bush said that he was not willing to make that commitment, he said, because it didn't fit our budgetary process. And so what he did instead was announce this money that had already been approved for emergency food assistance. And it just perpetuates the negative preconceived notion of Africa as a continent of starving people, but allows the president to present himself as a compassionate conservative. In the end, Tony Blair didn't get what he wanted on the issue of development assistance from George Bush.
They came a little close together on the idea of debt cancellation. That's an issue that has mobilized activists for many years. Those activists were largely erased from the media coverage this past week or so, but that wasn't the only thing missing from the conversation about forgiving debt. What kind of context about the debts that are owed by poor nations would have helped people trying to make sense of this story?
Right. Well, the story should begin with asking, what are the origins of these debts? Most of these debts, in fact, are illegitimate, what's known as odious debt. These were loans that were made to unrepresentative governments, mostly during the Cold War years, and they were used not to benefit the people of these countries, but to enrich the dictatorial rulers of the time. So people like Mobutu Sese Seko and the former Zaire reaped billions of dollars in loans from the World Bank, the IMF, from the U.S. and France. And now he's gone, but the people of that country are being told they owe $16 billion to the international financial institutions. Why should they pay this money instead of spending it at home on schools and clinics? The concept of odious debt is, in fact, a legal concept that the U.S. helped develop over a century ago. And in the case of Iraq, the Bush administration is saying Iraq's external debt of $120 billion is odious debt, and they appointed former Secretary of State James Baker to go around the world and get that debt canceled. And to date, he's been fairly successful, having gotten creditors to cancel some $70 billion of that debt. So it's a double standard when this concept of odious debt isn't applied to the debts of African countries.
There have been a lot of newspaper editorials that have congratulated the White House movement on this, but only one that I could find, the Christian Science Monitor, even mentioned this concept of odious debt and the double standard with Iraq. There's sort of a related theme is reform and responsibility among African governments. David Gregory of NBC News reported that this debt relief was going to go to what he called reform-minded African governments. Is that a euphemism, do you think, for something in particular?
Oh, very much so. The debt cancellation announcement refers only to 18 countries, 14 of which are in Africa. And you ask, why are those countries selected? Well, those are countries that for the last almost 10 years have had the big boot of the World Bank and the IMF on their throats. In other words, dictating the economic policies and hoops that these governments had to jump through in order to become eligible for debt relief. And these conditions included things like introducing user fees for poor kids attending schools where formerly the governments had been responsible for paying that education, and the same thing of user fees for poor citizens trying to make use of health facilities in any number of these African countries. Also, privatization of public utilities like water or electricity. So they're very harsh economic conditions, and they've had devastating consequences, particularly on the poor majorities in these countries. So if that's what's being termed as a responsible or reform-minded government, essentially it's those that have submitted the longest to the prescriptions of the World Bank and the IMF. But this debt cancellation is only for the few. The majority of countries in Africa and other impoverished countries around the world are not benefiting from this deal that's been announced. So when people say it's historic, they make it sound like the debts have been canceled for the world's poor, and it's simply not true.
Now, this emphasis on responsibility is pretty widespread. There's a Newsweek column by Fareed Zakaria in the June 20th edition. He wrote that, quote, "For people who speak of the need for a Marshall Plan for Africa should keep in mind that the continent has had, over the past five decades, the equivalent of five Marshall Plans," close quote. That almost makes it sound like there's been too much aid going to Africa in the past 50 years.
Yes, and that's another false notion. If you just look at U.S. assistance to Africa, which for the last several decades has averaged only about $1 billion of official development assistance for all 48 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, or some 700 million people. Now, you compare that to the $3 billion given to Israel annually, a small country of only 6.5 million people, you get a better sense of the lack of generosity in terms of the scale of U.S. assistance to Africa. But more importantly, perhaps, it's not just the quantity of aid. It's how this aid was provided to Africa. And again, most of those decades, since independence up to the end of the 80s, was the Cold War. And this money went into Africa not so much to promote development as to purchase political loyalties in the struggle between the West and the Soviet Union. It's only really since the fall of the Soviet Union that you had this opportunity and possibility of really investing in real development projects in Africa, and that precisely during that period you saw a decline in Western donor assistance to Africa. So the scale has not been that large, and the purpose of that aid has often not been oriented toward development. And then one has to understand that some 80 cents on the dollar of each dollar of U.S. foreign assistance comes back to the U.S. economy because it's used, or by law it's required to be spent on U.S. goods or services.
We have noticed that a lot of the civil society groups, the activist groups that have been working on debt cancellation, weren't featured very prominently in the media coverage about this announcement. Is it because a lot of these groups think this didn't go far enough, do you think?
Well, I think there's even a split among some of the civil society groups. On the one hand, we want to claim victory because this is a victory of the activists in the poor countries, some of their governments, and citizen activists around the world who've been campaigning in solidarity on debt cancellation. So you want, and it's important, to claim that victory. But at the same time, to recognize it doesn't go far enough, and it doesn't address the majority of countries that deserve and require debt cancellation. So we're cautious in the community broadly. We don't want to welcome it too much. But then part of the groups feel that, well, let's be pragmatic. We have to take what we can get and applaud the decision of the rich countries. Ourselves, we feel that only plays into the false framing of this issue, that somehow this is the chair charity and generosity of the rich countries that's to be credited here, as opposed to the force of a people's movement that have finally forced them to take this first, albeit a baby step. And we have to keep the pressure on to get as far as we want. But in general, unfortunately, the media often seems to think that civil society activists and movement-oriented organizations have less qualifications for analysis on these issues, and that's simply not true.
We've been speaking with Sally Booker. He's the executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C. You can find them online at www.africaaction.org. Sally Booker, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
For years, top-level U.S. military officials have insisted that they don't collect information on the number of Iraqis killed in the war. And, true enough, the Pentagon has refused to report on civilian deaths in Iraq. But in recent months, a growing number of news stories have appeared quoting military sources on the number of Iraqi insurgents killed by U.S. and allied forces. This development is troubling, says our next guest, Mark Benjamin. He's a national correspondent for Salon.com. Benjamin's latest article for the online site is titled Return of the Body Counts. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Mark Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here at Counterspin, we've called on journalists to report on all the costs and realities of the war, including civilian casualties. But you seem to be saying that this particular kind of body count reporting may not simply be inspired by an eagerness to provide accurate information. Tell us about that.
Well, there certainly are some indications that that may be true. What has happened is in the fall of 2004, right around the battle for Fallujah, which is one of the major battles you remember for this war, military commanders on the ground did start to release what they claimed were the body counts from battles. The reason why this is a little bit disturbing is twofold. One, we've had this experience once before when we were in Vietnam, and the fact that the military was essentially inflating body counts led to a serious credibility problem for the Pentagon, which turned out to be not true. Second of all, if our experience with Vietnam was any kind of indicator, it can ultimately lead to atrocities on the battlefield when soldiers go for higher and higher body counts. It's a dubious prospect.
Let me ask you, why do you think the Pentagon has begun releasing body counts at this late stage of the game?
Well, it's interesting because we don't know for sure. Actually, when I called the Pentagon and asked them why they had begun to release body counts, and this is after Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and other top Pentagon officials have said, we don't do body counts on the enemy, all of a sudden they start showing up in the fall of 2004. The Pentagon says they're simply still not doing it, and the military commanders in the field have just decided on their own to do so. When I talk to current and former military officials, they say that's probably not the case. You just don't start doing that without Pentagon approval. So the Pentagon says it's simply not happening, even though it clearly is. Why is it happening? Those former military officials speculate that as we get, I hate to say it, bogged down, or at least a critic would say, in Iraq, we are looking for some measure to show the American people that we're winning. It's not like we can land on the beach of Normandy and take Paris a few months later.
Well, in your Salon.com article, and as you've suggested earlier here, you suggest that the advent of enemy body counts in Iraq is reminiscent of Vietnam. You say this might be dangerous for one reason, because it could lead to an erosion in credibility or even further erosion in military credibility. Explain that for us.
What happened in Vietnam is General Westmoreland, who was running the war there in 1967 and 1968, increasingly used body counts to show that we were really taking it to the enemy there. And in fact, they were on the verge of defeat. That claim, of course, fell apart in 1968 with the Tet Offensive, with the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army. Launched a major assault on American forces in Vietnam, and that led to what they call the credibility gap. In other words, the Pentagon was saying we were winning the war, and we clearly were not. What is happening now in Iraq is we are starting to use body counts in the same way. The military is releasing these body counts after battles to show that we're really taking it to the enemy. However, there have been a number of cases, Fallujah being one example, there was another I can think of just a couple in March, where body counts have been floated both by the American military officials or the Iraqis, and those body counts on the ground later look very dubious when reporters have started to look into them.
Well, one of the stories that you recount in your article is about another Vietnam episode, and that was the experiences of the Tiger Force unit that were reported in 2004 in a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Toledo Blade. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that was interesting about that fabulous series by the Blade was that some of the soldiers there seen in that series said they were under extreme pressure to go get body counts, to get high body counts. I called a soldier, Dennis Stout, who served with Tiger Force in 1967 when these atrocities were occurring, and in fact he said that they were under extreme pressure to get high body counts, and he said basically what happens is if you start to pressure soldiers to get higher and higher body counts, he said they'll get you the body counts. They just won't always be enemy soldiers. In other words, at least in Vietnam, it led to the indiscriminate killing of civilians or contributed to it. Now, we have no evidence that indicates that that is happening in Iraq. But it's a dubious prospect. And once you open that Pandora's box or that can of worms, you never know what's going to come out.
Well, I thought one of the interesting things in your Salon.com article was how military in certain battles that have happened in Iraq so far were releasing maybe suspiciously round numbers of enemy killed, and that some of these numbers weren't really able to be certified once reporters had gone into those post-combat zones.
That's right. I mean, all you need to do is jump on Google and start looking at some of the headlines or look at the Department of Defense's website. They have their own information service where they release their articles, and you'll notice, for example, Operation Matador, 125 insurgents killed. That was in western Iraq last month. Fallujah, which we mentioned before, 1,200 killed. Unfortunately, when reporters have looked into those cases, those numbers seem to fall apart. In Fallujah, Dexter Filkins, for example, for the New York Times, who did some wonderful reporting on that battle, you know, afterwards walked around with the Marines and they just weren't finding bodies. There was a later report in another paper that there were only 76 bodies in a nearby martyr cemetery. I mean, in other words, it's unclear how the military is coming up with these numbers. And when reporters look into them on the ground, they just don't seem to make it.
Mark Benjamin, in your contacts with others from the Washington Press Corps, considering the historical antecedents, do you sense that other journalists are somewhat wary of these new body counts, as you are?
It's interesting. As far as I can tell, editors seem to be using those numbers from the military without checking them. And I understand it's very difficult to check the accuracy of military body counts, but they don't seem to be putting, for example, a line or something in the story that says, we don't have any way of telling whether this is, you know, completely false, 100% true, other words. I mean, in other words, it looks to me like editors are accepting these numbers from the military just because the military says that's what they are.
We've been speaking with journalist Mark Benjamin. His report, Return of the Body Counts, can be read online at Salon.com. Mark Benjamin, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.